This sound is a glacier in Iceland, recorded by Chris Watson. I'm Barrett Golding of Hearing Voices. My whole life I've lived in northern climates, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Montana. Every year by October, the cold comes, a freeze locks up the land, and we ask ourselves, why do we live here? Then we go sledding, skiing, skating. We see our first snowfall or a river icing up, and we tell ourselves, that's why we live here. That's why we love winter. And who knows? Maybe it's even true. This is Hearing Voices from NPR, the best of public radio, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This week, the forecast is for snow and ice. In December 1987, Alex Chadwick of NPR's All Things Considered asked his listeners for sledding stories.
This hill goes really fast.
There I was, sitting at the top of Shelburne's big, huge nightmare of a hill. We had asked for sledding stories, for listeners to join us on the day after Christmas, for a sledding party. And among the replies was a note from a high school English teacher in Staunton, Virginia, saying she was sending along an essay from a high school freshman. There I was, the essay began. There I was, sitting at the top of Shelburne's big, huge nightmare of a hill. It was solid white, and the sun was shining off it like a mirror. I took a big breath and another look. No one working for this program has been to Shelburne's Hill, but we know it anyway. It could be a city hill or a country hill, a steep, scary hill or a slow, winding hill. Any hill, all the hills. The hills people go to when it snows. Sledding starts with a hill, and then waits for that correct equation of damp and dry and cold that produces snow. An Oregon woman wrote us about her schoolgirl days at the Academy of the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Snow to me was then and is now one of the redeeming pleasures of being alive on this planet. The snow I remember in that northern Idaho panhandle was remarkable. It came in torrents and swells. It billowed and banked. The whirling, falling flakes made me dizzy. I can remember wondering if it was proper to pray for snow, to pray for it to stick. I did pray. I think even the nuns did. These are not feeble supplicants, nuns and schoolchildren. It snows regularly and heavily in northern Idaho. And in many other places, too. Finally, the snow comes, and the hill is ready, and then you must get ready.
I can remember at a very small age, my father coming home from work and taking me down into what we called our cellar, and he said that I was now old enough to have a sled.
These stories and writers come from every part of the country. This one from Worcester, Massachusetts.
And he had handed me a sled that had been well-worn, used by both my older brother and even older sister. And it already had my sister's name and my brother's name etched in it with a branding iron. And my father said that now I could have my name on it, that this would officially be my sled. So I recall his taking a poker and very ceremoniously got the poker at a red-hot flame and then crossed out my brother's name and put my name next to it. So that was my first step in the whole ritual. I had my own sled, and not only a sled, but a flexible flyer, which was really the supreme.
Daddy, I don't want to go up to the top.
No, you won't.
Writing from Connecticut, a woman told us of the time her son first went down a hill all by himself. He was 3 years old. They'd practiced that morning together on the gentle side slope of the hill by their house. And later, around noon, at the top of the hill, when he wanted to go by himself, she let him. He climbed onto the saucer, grabbed the handles, and then, she writes, he tipped over the crest of the hill in front, the long steep slope. The saucer swung around so that he was facing uphill as he sped backwards. His eyes widened. He yelled, "No!" And I felt the umbilical cord snap. My baby had thrown himself off the edge of the world and beyond my ability to protect him. Halfway down, the saucer hit a snow ridge and shot up in the air, thumping down on the other side and spinning toward the bottom until he lost his grip and went sprawling. I let out my breath and cheered and clapped for him. He sneaked a peek at his friends, decided not to cry, and struggled up, boasting about how he flew. How he flew that day on his saucer. Straight into his future, a more exciting ride than he could imagine.
Hey, did you see that? Dylan, come on.
Everyone wore snow suits, wool fabric pants with a little bib, and two straps that came over your shoulders, and then a jacket, and it was heavily padded, so everyone looked fat. Was before the days of synthetic fabrics, and you could feel the wetness, and sometimes you'd put your mouth to the sleeve of your jacket and just try to suck off the snow water that had soaked into the wool.
This letter, about a childhood decades ago in Jersey City, New Jersey. I remember best the bitter cold twilight one afternoon. My brother Paul and I were sharing a sled. We had one good pair of mittens and one pair with holes. The cold was painful, but at 50 I'm still warmed by the memory of the love I felt for Paul as we took turns each time down the hill, wearing the good mittens.
Hey, Dust, do you want to go down on my sled once?
Uh-uh.
It's fun!
If you don't go on this thing, you'll crash and burn.
No, I won't. I'm not going to go on that one.
I don't want to go on that one.
This one goes fast! This one goes fast!
Go double, Dust, to take
I was standing at the in the lawn section of the sled run with my sister. I was 5 and she was 3. And I had decided that I was going to go sledding, and she had decided she wasn't going to let me go sledding. So we stood there arguing, and she said she was going to just stand in the middle of the sled run and she wouldn't get off. And I kept telling her, get off, get off, get off, get out of my way. And she'd just stand there and say, no, no. And she was just as stubborn as you can imagine. And then finally, I just had it with her, and I said, "I'm going up, and I'm gonna sled down. And if you don't get out of the way, I'm gonna run you over." And she just kind of stood there, in her looking tubby in her snowsuit with her pink cheeks and her little bright black eyes, and she laughed at me, and she put her hands on her hips, and she just kind of dared me, and I went up there right to the top of the hill, and I just took my sled and I yelled at her, "I'm coming down," and she said, she just laughed, and she didn't believe me, and that did it. I put the sled down, I just flopped on it, and I went zooming down the hill, and there she was, this target right there, and I hit her. And over she went, over the sled went, and all the mothers and all the neighbors came running, and her leg was broken. And after that, when they saw, I just absolutely was not going to apologize. My mother started to call it an accident.
You go sledding as a kid, and it's the first time you really sense speed and danger. The sled goes faster than you thought it would, and then faster than you want it to. And the hard, icy run is just inches away, and you scream over it, with no car door or windows to shield you. And the sled rocks and bounces, and is hard to balance. Fall off, and you slide to a stop, and where a bare hand rubs against frozen snow, inexplicably, it burns as though snow were made of fire. A man writes from Plover Township, Wisconsin. What took Kill Hill to its sublimest vengeance was rain. Rain in February over a crust of old snow. rain in the night, and maybe thunder over a cold, hard pan of snow. Now, there's a lacquer job. Everything galvanized over with the sheen of a dull mirror wrinkling every light. Given a lacquered kill hill, an oak leaf will slide right through Tuesday before stopping, and even a shadow slips and has to dig in its heels to stay uphill. Such a hill happens once, maybe twice, in a kid's lifetime, and you take it when it happens. Skip school, duck church, miss supper, but don't lose a chance at kill hill with a lacquer finish.
Look out!
The stream is maybe yard, yard and a half wide, full of ice water, and these rocks.
This story is from a park in Washington, D.C., where the sledding hill is cut by a narrow stream.
And one place on it, a log or branch, maybe 4 or 6 inches in diameter, had fallen across it and gotten wedged in or frozen in. So it went right across the stream, like a tiny bridge. And we looked at this, and we went over and we jumped up and down on it and shook it to see if it would break or if the snow would fall off. And then we thought, if we could just get one runner of the sled lined up on that branch, and it would have to be absolutely straight, the least mistake, and you'd fly off and bang on the rocks. But if we could line it up like that, we could zip right across here, hit the smooth snow on the other side, and just keep going. It would be doubling the run.
I'm not going to try that. That's scary.
We went down the hill, and I guess because the boys were front and they were heavier, they were sort of leaning forward to make it all the more scary. We just got going too fast, and myself and Kim and Stephen, we all bailed out, but Andrew and John stayed on, and they just jumped this bank of the pond and went crashing into the pond, and the ice on it was sort of frozen, but it wasn't, you know, thick enough to hold anybody, and they crashed through the ice. And we thought they were going to drown, I think, you know. But we got them out.
And then we thought, if we could just get one runner of the sled lined up on that branch, we could zip right across here, hit the smooth snow on the other side, and just keep going. It would be doubling the run. When it was right, you get a slow start up at the top of the hill. And that was nice. It would give you time to pick out the exact line you wanted to come down. Then you get this blurring rush over the steepest part of the slope. You get a flatten out at the bottom so your stomach or your backside would stick good and tight to the sled. Then you get a last chance turn to line up with that branch. Get a chance to roll, pick the starboard runner up 6 inches, maybe a foot in the air. And then you're just flying over the stream for an instant, and then you kind of touch down on the far side and take this long, long glide before you come to a stop. It's just perfect.
A city or suburban child could think that a flexible flyer is the best sled in the world. And indeed, it is very good technology for snow and ice. But there are other sleds. An Illinois farmer wrote to say he'd used regular sleds as a kid and had farm improvised, too. He said once he'd gone sledding on a grain shovel.
You can sit in the shovel part and hold the handle in front of you, hang on to it, and you can go down the hill on it. They're real good. Yeah, there are a lot of things you can use for sleds other than just a sled. You can, you know, of course, use an old car hood or a piece of roofing tin.
And here's a story from New Mexico.
You go to the mountains to go sledding, and they call it sledding pretty much. And you get up there, and it turns out that what they had in mind is they have a bunch of inflated inner tubes. So you just put your little bum down in the donut hole, and you throw your legs and your arms over the side, and you let go. And you go spinning down the hill, and it's sort of a free fall, and you can't steer or guide it particularly like you could sleds. And it's a wonderful experience. It's a big rubber cushion, and you just kind of bump around and bump off of things until you hit, you know, the big snowbank at the bottom, and then somebody grabs your tube from you, and they go running up to the top of the hill to do it themselves.
And a letter from California. It snowed there a couple of weeks ago, even in the southern part of the state, but usually it does not. And sledding requires extraordinary measures. A woman wrote from Beverly Hills recalling a December from her girlhood when her grandparents put on fur coats in the house to act out cold weather rituals familiar from their earlier lives back east. And listening to them, the girl was inspired. I snatched a large cardboard soap crate from the cellar, her letter goes, took it to the front lawn, and sledded down the grass onto the sidewalk and past two neighbors' houses. I did this several times, just to get the feel of it. And when the box gave out, I went back into the kitchen, and in the high spirits of the holiday atmosphere, I drank eggnog with my grandparents. We could only hope that when the rare snow fell this year in Southern California, the woman found something more substantial than a cardboard soap crate so she could sample snow sledding.
There was great measuring at the bottom of the hill. If two people ended up approximately the same distance, there would be arguing and lines drawn and a decision made as to who had really won that particular feat on that occasion. And then you'd try to beat your mark the next time, or you'd beat your friend or your enemy's mark, whatever it might be.
And the boys loved nothing better than to stand halfway down the hill and suddenly come out at us and cut us off from the ride. And it made it pretty tough for the girls. They had to defend themselves. And we really wanted to just have a peaceful ride, but they wouldn't let us. So that the one that suddenly announced to me I could have a free ride, that was a whole new dimension that I'd never experienced before. What he did was, he had been the chief cutter offer. But one day he stood up and announced that he was going to allow me to go down because he liked me. And I didn't know what to do. I had no idea how to act, so I simply made the run, listening to everybody hoot and holler, and I was very embarrassed. But later on I thought, well, that was kind of nice. Maybe there is a better way to be with a boy and a girl than just fighting with each other all the time. And I guess it was, in a way, the beginning of adolescence.
Winter without snow is a grim, mean act. With it, the world is beautiful and fresh, and for anyone with a sled, joyous. Before it snows, you're indoors all the time, it seems, and then you go out and stay too long until you're cold, wet, exhausted, delirious.
You know, you're having fun, and I think I didn't want to leave for one reason or another, and the next thing I know, I happened to put my hand up to my ear, and it was like sticking out straight from my head. Of course, I had to go down the hill a couple more times, even with that. By the time I got into the meeting hall there at the Farm Bureau Hall, where we had our 4-H meetings, somebody noticed in there that it was sticking straight out from my head. So I was real worried about it, too. You know, and then the thing is, you're kind of embarrassed about something like that. You know, you don't want everybody to think you're a dummy, you know, and then you went outside and you didn't take care of yourself and you froze in the air. So I remember putting it under a stocking cap, you know, and I tried not to tell anybody about it. I figured it'd just go away. You know, when you're 16 or something, you know, you figure that kind of stuff, you know.
One more time, then we'll go, okay? Everybody else has gone home. We might as well, too. Look at the sunset. Karen, look at the sun.
I spent a pretty miserable night, I remember. You know, while that ear was thawing out. But it gradually went back to normal. Now whenever my ears get cold, and they do, every time it gets just a little bit chilly outside, I think back to that sledding party.
Finally, when we were done riding our hills for the day, this letter about a boyhood on Long Island in New York. Finally, when we were done, as much as our time, energy, or condition would allow, we began the walk home, gradually realizing along the way how cold it was and how little our soaking wet clothes helped the situation. The routine when we got home remains one of the fondest memories of these years, where we would strip down from our wet clothes by the downstairs furnace, go dashing upstairs and into warm, dry pajamas, and slip under the heavy winter blankets of our beds, warm and waiting. "It's ready," my mother would finally call out. "Hot cocoa's on." There's never food or drink so good as the one you want the most. And for me, then, that was it. And after the cocoa, back under the covers of my still warm bed, I felt so good that I couldn't keep from giggling.
Thank you.
We had asked for letters about sleds and sledding, and the letters came, heartfelt, insightful, interesting, so that we came to think of the sledding letters that arrived and still arrive as a Christmas present you asked for that turns out even better than you'd expected. Our thanks to the many, many of you who sent careful, wonderful letters, more than we had time for. And thanks especially to the writers we have included, Susanna Arnold, Joan Blaze, Dan Brinkmeyer, Elizabeth Casey, Lois Conklin, Martin Ginsburg, Justin Isherwood, Deborah Norris Lattimore, Catherine J. Lord, Becky McKeon, Phil Musgrove, Carol Robin, Mary Tangway Webb, and the high school freshman from Staunton, Virginia, Shad Yeager. Thanks also to recording engineer Barrett Golding in Bozeman, Montana, who risked life, limb, and microphone to gather the sounds of sledding. The Sledding Party was produced by NPR's Katie Davis.
That was NPR's Alex Chadwick. Our winter weather advisory continues in a minute with more snow and ice from Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
The largest glacier in Iceland is named Vatnajökull. It covers more than 8% of the country and makes these sounds. Recorded by Chris Watson for a CD Weather Report. Welcome back to Snow and Ice from Hearing Voices. I lost a friend this year. He was climbing the Tetons, slipped onto a snowfield, couldn't stop his slide, and went right off a cliff. Another friend was hit by a falling boulder. Now she's paralyzed in a wheelchair. The mountains will take some of us. That's part of life here. This is Utah producer Scott Carrier.
If you've been to Salt Lake City, you know there are mountains just east of town. They're not really big mountains. The highest is 11,500 feet. But they are close mountains. They're like the playground in the city's backyard. In the summer, we hike and climb. In the winter, we hike and ski. And because Salt Lake City is both physically and culturally isolated from the rest of the world, we very often grow up here, learning our most important lessons not in school and not at home, but up in the mountains where we play. This story is about a backcountry ski tour that began in play but ended in tragedy. It happened 9 years ago. 7 young men went skiing, and there was an avalanche. 3 of them were caught in the avalanche, and 1 of them died. This is something that happens 2 or 3 times a year around here. Somebody dies in an avalanche. Some people say it serves them right for skiing in dangerous places. Others say it's a good way to go. Some people explain it by saying accidents happen, but then other people say there are no accidents. I interviewed 5 of the 6 survivors of this avalanche because I thought by hearing all their stories, I could learn more about how avalanches happen and how people get caught in them. I asked each of the five to tell me what they remembered of the day, from where they thought it began to where they thought it ended. And this is what they said.
Well, we could probably start at about 7 o'clock in the morning of April 2nd, 1979. We had had about 2 feet of fresh snow, if not more, maybe 30 inches of fresh snow had fallen in the previous day and a half. And we left our homes and went on up Big Cottonwood Canyon to a drainage called Mule Hollow.
So it's a pretty big party. Dwight, myself, Chris Larson, Alan, Greg McIntyre, a friend of Greg and Alan's from Maine, and Larry Olson from Oregon.
It was a very experienced crew. Everyone knew about avalanches. We all had PEEPs, which are avalanche beacons. We all had shovels. We all knew what to do, and we all knew the danger.
And the day started out with the tail end of a storm. And the clouds were like remnants, the last gasp of the storm trying to get up and over the Wasatch. It was a neat day, neat weather.
Oh, it was the best. It was a classic Wasatch tour where you start in one area, ski a run, hike up to another area, ski that, hike up somewhere else, ski something else, and it's too much fun.
It was Dwight's birthday, and we were sort of celebrating. We'd been having a real good time that day.
Beautiful weather, perfect skiing. You know, it's April 2nd. Really, really good snow.
Snow's flying over your head, and you're sort of down in it as much as skiing through it.
Face shot powder, even for me. Being 6'4", you know.
It was one of those periods where we just couldn't stop skiing.
So it was getting on towards sunset, or late in the day. You could tell the day was closing to an end, and out further out the ridge, not truly above Desolation Lake, but in a lower basin, there's a ridge that is pretty high above a lower basin just below Desolation, with a lot of shots on it, unskied, and you know, like, to me, it was like the sirens calling us over there. And I have a real vivid image in my head of traversing out that ridge. It wasn't really a climb. We pretty much stayed at the same altitude, but it's kind of a broad ridge in some points. And a real vivid image of most of the party out in front of me and the sun going down and some really great sunset colors going on, or pre-sunset colors. Almost an alpenglow, but in my mind it's more violet than the red. And a few lingering clouds around. I mean, just it's pretty special or cosmic kind of a setting.
I was breaking trail, and it was out a ridge that we call Razor Ridge because it is a very steep ridge, and the slope falls off steeply on both sides. One is a south-facing side, and one is a north-facing side. And we were going to ski the north-facing side. I remember crossing the slope being very scared. Just worried sick, just being on top of it going,
I didn't feel good about it, I mean, I just had a feeling. I didn't like it. I didn't like the way it looked. It didn't look that bad when you're over on it. I mean, before you got on it. But once I was on top of it, I told Dwight, I said, let's spread out a little bit here. I yelled back to him, let's spread out a little bit. And I said, I don't really feel good about this. Let's go a little further down the ridge and let's look at something else.
It seemed to me there was no communication. That's because I was in my own space and not aware of group safety at that point or what might be presenting itself in front of us other than a great run.
I didn't think there's any
any communication about that this is unsafe, let's not ski it. If any of the members thought that the slope was unsafe, they certainly didn't let me know.
At this point, which is, you know, another learning thing, is that our group, without us knowing it, had split into two groups. The three of us, Dwight and Alan and I, were standing on top of one run we were about to ski, and the other four were already skiing the slope that we had crossed earlier that I was afraid to go near. We didn't even know it.
The first person to ski it, his name was Tim. Tim was out visiting from Maine, and he started down on the right side, but he cut way out onto the slope, traversing left and then cutting back. And I remember the group of us watching from above said, "No, don't do that. Don't expose yourself so much to the open slope. Get back towards the trees." And he cut back to the right and stayed a little bit closer. When Greg went, we advised him to stay tight to the trees on the right-hand side, which he did.
So Greg and his friend skied down and waited in the fall line of the path that we were going to ski.
They were standing sort of on a mine dump, which would be sort of comparison to a ski jump, you know, that's got a little ramp up to the end, and they were standing out on this little point, I guess, and the assumption that was an island of safety, a place on the slope that you could stand, where if an avalanche occurred, you'd be in a relatively safe spot.
So with that, I jumped into it, and skiing parallel style, so carrying pretty good speed. Made one turn, made another turn, and out in front of me I saw the snow fracturing and breaking up in blocks.
The first indicator that anything had happened was somebody yelling, "Avalanche," and we turned around and started running back towards where it was, and I remember looking down, seeing this huge dust cloud.
We could hear the cracking of the trees snapping in half.
And I was just blown away. I was going, "Oh my God, this is wild."
And all the snow's billowing up. It's like a big white cloud, and we could see Greg McIntyre and Tim. We could see him running, scurrying to get out of the way. But this thing was moving, I don't know how fast, probably 100 miles an hour at the bottom of the mountain. And it just engulfed him.
And it was a nasty, it was not, you know, not a really cut and dried slide path. I mean, it went, you know, it broke out fairly wide and then went down through a lot of trees and it spread out. And so it wasn't like you could just look and see it was in a confined path and you knew exactly where to look for the people, because you didn't. And we all took our peeps out, and it wasn't real organized at that point because, you know, we're sort of in a state of shock. And we got down to the bottom, and Timmy Sears was standing on top of the snow, frantic, because there were three people caught in the avalanche, Dave, Greg, and Tim, and he was the only one standing on top. And he was, of course, you know, he'd been caught in the whole turmoil of the thing and ended up on top. And he was freaking out.
So I came to a stop, and yelled really loud. And so it was black, and I felt quite trapped. And then kind of got my presence of mind about, you know, my situation. And realized that was stupid to have yelled because I needed to conserve my breath. And kind of relaxed and peed my pants because I was so tense. And I peed my pants and kind of got it together and said, "Well, you know, if I'm thinking to myself, if I'm going to survive this, then I have to really calm down and conserve my breath and not panic or struggle." And then as I calmed down, I tuned in. I could hear my peeps peeping away, and I thought, "God, I hope those guys are quick. I'm glad I can hear my peeps."
A peeps, it's an avalanche transceiver. Everybody wears one on transmit all the time. As if somebody gets involved in an avalanche, everyone turns that's not involved, and it turns theirs to receive. it's not a directional device. So to track the person down, you have to use this bracketing technique where you go, you walk as far as you can to the point where the sound diminishes, and then turn around and in the exact opposite direction walk back to where the sound diminishes again. Then you have two points of equal low sound, and you walk to the middle. Going at 90 degrees, you do it again. And you continue doing that, and through this series of bracketing, you eventually locate the person. And at this point, things kind of get hazy in my memory, because I was trying to... I remember trying to imagine, you know, I'd been through one avalanche class at that point, so I sort of knew what to do, but not, I'd never really practiced anything enough for it to be instinctive. Dwight was with me looking for Dave. Alan was off on the side looking for Greg. He found Greg first and started yelling for help because he must have realized that Greg was in bad shape.
To get his face out, he was buried in a prone position, head downhill, or head uphill, but down. And his arms were completely spread out like this. You know, one arm, you know, sort of in a spread eagle position with his legs sort of wrapped back over his head. And so he didn't have any, he wasn't at all in a fetal position like Carter said he was buried, where you can you know, your diaphragm's more relaxed and you can have a little bit of reserve air in your lungs. He was completely the opposite, you know. So we were frantically trying to get him out, and we couldn't even pull him out before we got each arm out. I mean, it wasn't like we could roll him over because he was buried in such a strange position. You know, his head was way down, and his arms were both out the side, and he still had his ski pole straps on too. So you had to completely dig out each arm, pull his straps off to get his arm out, and then Greg's a big guy, so we had to pull him completely out of the hole and get him up on the surface. And then as soon as I got him up, I yelled for someone, we got to do CPR. And, you know, I started doing one-man CPR, and Tim didn't know how to do CPR. So one of the other, I think Chris Larson or somebody came over and started doing CPR. We started doing two-man CPR, which is a lot more effective than one-man.
And it was really pretty pleasant. The state of unconsciousness was pretty pleasant. And, peaceful, and it was, you know, had I died in that event, I would have been okay with it. I mean, I wasn't panicked, I wasn't remorseful, I wasn't seeing my life flash before my eyes. It wasn't an unpleasant experience, and I guess they must have, the guys that were digging me up must have disturbed the snow around me within a few feet of me before they actually got to me, because I heard them and I was again conscious. Oh, I just remembered. I just remembered something. I was lying there in the hole, and I think I must have still been trapped, and I could look up over the edge of this pit, and it was getting dark, but I just saw Dwight's head, just his head look into the hole, and he was like happy, you know. I responded to him, and he was pretty happy. And he was going, he was taking off for help. And then I realized that that Greg was in trouble, and Alan and some of the other guys in the party were working on Greg and trying to revive him. And I must have wandered around and pretty dazed for a while these guys were trying to revive Greg. And I think I must have come back to the group occasionally and helped or done something. Because one real strong impression I have is... I can only describe it as knowing inside that Greg had died, and a real strong image and feeling of his spirit departing.
And it was getting dark by this time, and so we sent, it didn't, you know, we definitely were going to, Greg was not coming too. We couldn't get a carotid pulse, which is the carotid artery right next to the throat. We couldn't get a pulse, and it was really frustrating. I mean, that was probably, it was definitely the most frustrating experience of my life, you know, doing the CPR and just the whole search, because in my heart and in my, you know, in my soul, I knew he was dead. And, you know, even before, you know, I knew he was dead.
We took turns doing CPR on Greg while Dwight went out for help. He ended up getting a hold of Alta Central. They sent out a helicopter with a dog, the doctor, and one of the assistant snow safety director at Snowbird. Once the doctor got there, they decided, you know, they'd... What's the word? They decided he was dead, and they flew us all out at that point in the helicopter back to Silver Fork Lodge. And by that point, the television crews were at Silver Fork Lodge. We got out in full force of the lights, and it was a really weird experience.
There was quite a scene coming from that place. I just remember a lot of lights and vehicles and news people and that kind of stuff. And so they took us into Silver Fork, and we had some cocoa or coffee and gave a brief report to the police and the snow ranger. And they dismissed us and sent us home. And I remember the last, you know, the closing of the event for me was going home and sitting in a bathtub and just noticing how much pain I had in my both big toes, which a couple days later turned black and blue. And to me, that was, you know, kind of closing the day. And there's a lot of feelings and history and relationships and stuff that are affected since then. But that's how I remember the day and the event.
That was Dave Carter, Dwight Butler, Alan Murphy, Chris Larson, and Larry Olson, in memory of avalanche victim Greg McIntyre, produced by Scott Carrier. Coming up on Snow and Ice from Hearing Voices, we train with three Olympic speed skaters.
You can see it from Interstate 90, a huge ice rink just below the mountains of the Continental Divide near Butte, Montana. It's called the United States High Altitude Sports Center, elevation 5,600 feet. And this rink is the second highest speed skating track in the world. It's also the fastest in the country. Racers come here to work with coaches Mike Crow and Susan Sandvig of the U.S. Speed Skating Association. When I was there, they were getting ready for the Olympic trials. I watched some of the women skaters, Tara Laszlo, Chantel Bailey, and Mary Doctor, go through their training. They work out every weekday, all day. And on the weekends, they race.
Go to the start.
Before my race, I usually I meditate kind of for a little bit, and I go through my race, and I see myself skating my race and switching lanes, and I just take it stroke by stroke.
Ready?
When it comes down to it, all of us are physically capable of doing it, but when you get to the line, it's who's tough enough mentally.
I'm thinking quick steps for the first four steps. Then I'm thinking get low and skate. And then I'm just thinking, go, 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 set up the turn, right?
The rink has two parallel 100-meter straightaways connected by long half-circle turns. To cut wind resistance, racers wear a skin-tight Lycra suit from head to ankle. Their steel skate blades are about a foot and a half long, but just 1 millimeter wide, the thickness of a dime. Their top speed's 40 miles per hour.
When you're able to accelerate out of the turn, you feel a nice lift on those first couple straightaway strokes.
They push from side to side on the straightaways with long, powerful strokes. On the turns, one arm, their inside arm, stays tucked behind their back, and the other swings like a pendulum in rhythm with their steps.
during a race, I'm not really thinking. I feel like I'm in like a meditation kind of, and I can hear people yelling to me, you have to, you know, do this, and cheering me on.
Do you try to yell technique things, what they should be thinking about during the race and their lap times? I time each lap that they do, and they know in their head what kind of schedule they want to be on, what kind of race they want.
1-4! 1-9! Say we have to go a 32.5, and it's a 32.7. Push a little harder coming out of the corner. Or if you are going 33s, build your corners harder.
Move your legs fast. Fast. Faster. Stay low. Swing your arms. Set up your turn again. Go around it. Stay on your heels.
Accelerate out of the turn. Then in the last 100 meters, I'm thinking skate. Stay low. Skate. Stay low.
I look up and I see the time, and it's bad. It's always bad.
That was a good 500. There's a lot of effort in that.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So you really showed you were ready to race mentally. We weren't far off physically. As you'll see, I'll give you the program for the next week. It's really cut back. Give people a little more chance to go home, relax. Don't have to feel bad about relaxing, okay? People get a lot out of relaxing. 3 weeks before trials are a big event.
This year, in December, we have the trials for the 92 team, and I think I have a pretty good shot at it. There's a few of us girls here that have a good shot at making it.
It's not just on the ice, it's everything. Everything they do. I mean, when they should go to sleep, like when they study, what they eat, everything. They need to learn how to live more like champions. And some of them do it pretty good, and others, when we first see them, like eat absolutely terribly or stay up all night. And a lot of these kids are still in high school, and so they have to study also. Their normal day is we get up at 7, we jog at 7:15, they eat breakfast, they get on the ice at 9:45, we get back here around 12:15, they eat lunch, and then they take a nap.
You go home and you eat lunch.
And then
we
get up. Then they get up at 3.
And then you might go to the weight room, or you might go to the field, and do some sprints, or you might go to hill and run some hill runs. It depends. And then you go to the ice again and skate your second workout of the day. And then go home and eat and go to bed early.
That's it.
And there's always, like, you always warm down after every skating workout. A lot of stretching, a lot of eating.
A lot of warming up.
A lot of sleeping.
A lot of eating.
And there are some days I feel like I just can't get enough. Like last night after the race, I said, I feel like a bottomless pit because I had 2 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and 2 glasses of milk. And then I had 2 bowls of spaghetti noodles with sauce on there. And then someone made popcorn, so I was munching on popcorn.
French fries.
And someone had made rice, this rice mixture with raisins and apples, and I ate a bowl of that with cottage cheese mixed in there. You're getting up there in calories.
And you drink all those calories, too.
Yeah, and plus we drink a high-carbohydrate fluid, so.
It's like 3,000, I think,
a day. And that was just dinner. I mean, I had a pretty big lunch, and I always eat a big breakfast, so.
I ate those all-you-can-eat buffets.
How old are each of you?
26.
30.
We're geriatric.
Just about. I feel that way sometimes. My knees ache.
Mine too. But we're fast,
yep.
Right? They used to say that older people couldn't do it, but I think the only reason they said that was the older people never had an opportunity to keep going because they had to start working because
right.
They weren't supported.
That's
well.
That's a good point.
But now they are, and I think they're proving that you don't have to give it up right away.
Right.
You might need a little more sleep or something.
Yeah, no doubt.
And I am married a year, and I haven't seen my husband in 3 months, and that's my husband's understanding and supportive, so that helps a lot. But he knew before I married him that my goals, you know, were to make the Olympic team and stuff, so.
I'm missing out on things. I mean, I don't have a husband. I don't have a career yet. I don't have a house. I don't have a dog. Whatever people might, I don't have a baby. Those kinds of things I'm putting off and putting off.
Why speed skating? I mean, what do you still like about it? Obviously, you've been through a lot and have stuck with it. Why this sport?
Olympics.
Yeah, really, why this sport? Your feet get tied in little skates. It's cold.
I love to go
round
fast.
Round and around and around. For me, I never did reach my potential yet, and I want to do that before I quit.
The Olympic trials ended Sunday. 12 men, 8 women made the team. Among this year's Olympic speed skaters are Tara Laszlo.
I just had this drive that I wanted to be the best.
And three-time Olympian Mary Doctor.
Medal in the Olympics. That's kind of my goal this year.
Chantel Bailey missed by just one person. She'll be trying again for the 94 team.
I've always wanted to go to the Olympics since I was like five.
Speed skaters Chantel Bailey, Tara Laszlo, and Mary Doctor were recorded back in 1991. This glacial recording is from Chris Watson's CD, Weather Report. He's online at chriswatson.net. And there's links to everything you heard in this hour at hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.